Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My mother, Caroline Kilborn, is not with us today, but tune in next week and she'll be back on the air. We have a very topical book today. It's a futuristic book, but it's about a topic that I think many people can really relate to. And that is social media, but in a fictionalized kind, almost dystopian way, not totally dystopian. Our guest is Megan Angelo, and Megan's writing has appeared in publications like the New York Times, where she helped launch city comedy coverage, Glamour, where she was a contributing editor and wrote a column on women and television, and Elle, where she has written about everything from Lauren Conrad's Instagram to NRA TV. She lives in Pennsylvania with her husband and three kids, and Followers is her first novel. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Megan.
Thank you, Monica. I'm excited to be here.
Now, what part of Pennsylvania are you in?
I live in the Lehigh Valley, which, if you know the state at all, is sort of about an hour and a half from New York. It's kind of smack between Philly and New York.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Lancaster County.
Yes, I know Lancaster County. That's where all my furniture is from. I love to. But you cannot beat Amish furniture on quality or prices. So there's my plug for the Lancaster furniture industry.
That is quite true. Now, we moved away from there when I was 14, and I've only been back a handful of times since then, but my family goes back 13 generations there. And
oh my goodness,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, in fact, my maiden name was Her, so that's a very common name in the area. And
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And my like 13 or 15 or something great-grandfather was Hans Her, who got a land grant from William Penn to settle in that area. So
that is some serious Pennsylvania cred right there.
Yeah, no kidding. And did you grow up in Pennsylvania too, or are you a newcomer?
I am not a newcomer. I actually grew up in Quakertown, so even closer to Lancaster. Quakertown is closer to Philly, and it's sort of this, farmer-originating town that sort of began to sprawl and become a true suburb while I grew up there in the 80s and 90s. And it's famous for its farmers market, which people used to come from many, many miles around before there were farmers markets everywhere. So it was a really sweet, sort of sleepy and simple place to grow up. And I guess I'm Pennsylvania for life because I got away to New York for a while, but I'm back. And especially now, I find it to be such an interesting place. It's a true mix of cultures and beliefs, and no one can accuse me of being inside the bubble, that's for sure.
Well, that is true. And one thing I did notice, the times I've been back is that compared to here in Iowa, which is where I went to high school, where most of my classmates left the area after college, it seems like most of the people that I grew up with in Lancaster County stayed there. It's a very stable community.
Yeah, I think you're right. I find that with people I grew up with too, for the most part. And like I said, I spent my 20s in New York, and as a writer, my business is really centered in New York and occasionally in Los Angeles. So those were two places I thought about living, but knowing that I wanted to try to write for the rest of my life, I really felt like I'm never going to be someone who can own stories that are based in places like that. I want to be somewhere where I'm one of, not that many people who's looking at this corner of the world. And so I've loved living here and being inspired by I live in like a basically a middle class suburb that also has upper class parts and working class parts, and is part city and is part township. And is part of, it's a town that has changed a lot from sort of a manufacturing town to a really artistic and vibrant place in this century. And I just find it endlessly fascinating. So I'm really glad to be here.
Although your novel, Followers, is partly set in New York City.
Yes, that's my one New York story. I was like, okay, this is my love letter to my 20s. And it's so funny, just as I don't live in New York anymore, I feel like a lot of the qualities that I once shared with some of the characters are things I've outgrown, I think, for the better. So yeah, it's definitely a bit of a retrospective for me at this point.
So tell us a little bit about sort of the overall theme of this, of the plot of this story, of this novel, Followers.
Yeah, yeah. So Followers has two timelines. And one timeline is set in 2015 and 2016. That's kind of where the whole story begins. And in that timeline, it's about two girls named Orla and Floss who were thrown together via Craigslist. They're Craigslist roommates in a rental. And Orla is a blogger for a celebrity website. Floss wants very much to be a celebrity, and they team up to kind of make this happen. And then in the other timeline, which is in 2051, we meet Marlo, who is the future version of an influencer or a Kim Kardashian. She's on camera almost 24/7. She lives in a gated community in California of government-appointed celebrities, and she can hear the feedback from her followers inside her head all of the time. So the fun
of
the book
is that.
I know. It's an absolute nightmare. I mean, it's hard enough to put your phone down when someone is discussing you. I can't imagine if it could wake me up in the middle of the night as it does for her. But basically the journey of the book is like, how are these women connected and what happened to America in between 2015 and 2051 that makes it look so different in the future?
And very early in the book, we get this, we learn that there was something called the spill, although that really changed how people viewed social media and the internet, although we don't find out what exactly that was until very close to the end of the book. So why did you choose to make that kind of a mystery?
I chose to make it a mystery because I wanted people, you know, by the time people get to this part of the book where they find out what the spill is, they've been thinking about phones and social media and sharing for, I don't know, 200 and some pages. And I think this is stuff we all think about a lot and like sort of things we do all day. But once in a while, we feel that worry of like, is this okay? Is this something I should be doing? And I hoped that, you know, while people were reading up to the spill, they would be guessing essentially and trying to imagine what their version of the worst possible nightmare perpetrated upon them by their phones could be. And, you know, I think the spill, it's funny because I read my Goodreads reviews, even though you're not supposed to. And it's almost right down the middle of people saying, wow, I never really saw it coming in terms of what the spill was. And people who are like, I knew exactly what it was going to be. And I take no offense to that predictability claim, because in some ways, I think we've all thought about something like this happening.
Well, I got to tell you, this week, as I was reading the book, a friend of mine told me that they had gotten, and completely, they, you know, I hadn't talked about the book or anything, but that he had received an email saying that they had something, that whoever sent the email had recorded something using his computer cameras, and that if he didn't pay them, it would be released to all of the contacts in his email. And my first thought is it's probably a scam. But he had gone to the police about it, and they really didn't know what to do.
Oh, that's comforting.
Yeah. And, of course, this is a small town, maybe even a big city. There'd be, like, cybercrime people that would have a better idea. But he said, you know, there's nothing that could be illegal that he'd done, but maybe something embarrassing if it had been released. And But he ended up contacting his IT department, who were able to trace the email and figure out it was a scam. So, but,
well, that's terrifying.
I know.
And like, do you know what is the most terrifying part of that to me is that we really aren't in a position anymore where if you get an email like that, you can just say to yourself with great confidence, this has to be a scam. I mean, because you hear about people's home security cameras getting hacked into, and all sorts of privacy invasions. So you can't really just kind of laugh it off. It's something that feels realistic, and that's really spooky.
Well, for a while, my daughter was putting a post-it note over her laptop camera all the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
I think there was some movie that she saw that after that she was doing that. I just figure I don't have my computer on when I'm like doing anything that would matter, and it's like not in my bedroom.
It's funny, my parents have that too, and it's like this beautiful sleek new Apple product and then a piece of post-it with like 350 pieces of scotch tape over it. But hey, you know what, I get it.
they're protecting themselves.
Yes, indeed.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Megan Angelo, author of Followers. So what made you think of this concept for this book?
The concept, I mean, it came to me, you know, in pieces. The book is big, and there's a lot of stuff in the book, but the moment that it all kind of began was I was writing in my diary one day. This would have been in 2015. It was shortly after I had my first son, and I was writing a lot about him. And I thought about him reading it someday, or like my kids, my grandkids reading it someday. And then I realized that I have written volumes of diaries in cursive, and that my children, I think, will probably be able to make it out from having me around. But that, you know, certainly my grandkids and generations going forward are probably not going to be able to decipher cursive too easily. And I just sat with that because I thought I would love to write something that goes into the future, but that sort of hinges on moments like that, more things that your grandmother would say to you, hey, this is how it used to be in my day. And less so, you know, the true sci-fi that we associate with the future. So that sort of set the tone for everything.
Hmm. Well, my mother, Caroline, who is usually my co-host, was an English teacher. And she's very upset about the fact that they don't teach cursive anymore. And she'll say, but, you know, they're not even going to be able to read the Constitution. Or, you know, all these mm-hmm. historical documents, it's all going to be lost. And I got to admit,
it is very strange.
Yeah. It's sort of like, I mean, people do still need to write things down on paper sometimes. And cursive is a whole lot faster than printing. But I guess.
I know. Yeah, I just asked. I actually was speaking with another teacher this week about this, and he teaches high schoolers. So I said to him, well, maybe you can tell me, how do they sign their names? And he said they don't know cursive, but they sort of fashion a cursive-like tool just for writing their names. Like, they'll basically print it, but they'll experiment with different ways to connect the letters until they come up with something they like. But beyond that, lots of them don't know cursive, at least in his classroom. So I found that really interesting too.
Wow. Now in the Followers, you have, you know, this before timeline and when everybody's pretty glued to their phones. And then you have the after timeline when people are resistant to that because of what happened in the spill, which we don't know what that was. So they're resistant to being online and sharing things, and yet you have the government pushing them to do so with these devices, which are even more intrusive in some ways than phones. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the device and how you came up with that concept.
So when I sat down and tried to think about how people would communicate in the future. The thing that I kept thinking about was something that bothers me on a daily basis, which is for all that we use them, our phones are not really convenient. They're not really streamlined or optimal. I mean, we have to hold them in our hands like a little claw and duck our heads over them in a way that makes our necks hurt. It's like, it's not an ideal experience. And so I thought, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'll have something that relies on brainwaves, sort of like the stuff that Elon Musk is testing with his Neuralink incubator. And, you know, there will be no screen. There will be nothing to hold. And you won't even have to say anything out loud. Instead of speaking to Siri, you will just, I call them intuitions in the book, you'll just think a command forcefully and Siri will answer you inside your head. There will be no sound whatsoever. And I was like, great. Well, that's elegant. And then I was like, oh, that's also super invasive and really creepy. But I, you know, I just went with it because I thought, of course, it would be the perfect thing to facilitate the life of someone like Marlo, who is on camera all the time and taking direction from writers and network executives. But obviously, you don't want to hear that as the audience. You want to think she's just living this dramatic and twist-filled life.
Other than the fact that it's like 24/7, how similar do you think Marlo's life in the Constellation community, where everybody is on camera, is to today's reality shows, like you mentioned, the Kardashians? Is it, do you think it's very similar in concept?
I mean, I do, but it's funny, even since I wrote the book, or during the process of writing the book, the analogy shifted a little bit. Like, reality television used to sort of rule the pop culture scene in the early aughts. And, you know, traditional media still ruled the pop culture scene a lot. In this book, you see Orla, who writes for a website, kind of being the gatekeeper for who gets famous. But really, people on Instagram don't need any of that anymore. Everything pretty much happens on Instagram, and TV might be a bonus, and, you know, a Vogue cover might be a bonus, but all they need to make money and get followers is Instagram. So I sort of see Constellation as an extension of that, both in the fact that it's sort of designed to look like straight out of an Instagram filter. It's got these trees that the network execs can change the color of. The sunrises are all choreographed, and, you know, the sky is always the same color. So I really see it as an extension of that. But what I think is similar to Constellation that exists right now is that, yeah, it is weird that Marlo can hear her followers in her head all the time. But I'll tell you what, like, this is the first time in my life that I'm able to look at my phone many times a day and see that I'm getting some kind of feedback, you know, someone posting the book on Instagram or writing to me on Twitter. And it's easy to get addicted to it. I mean, it's not embedded in my head, but I'm still picking up my phone all the time to see it, and I can hardly resist. So that's the main parallel to me.
I agree. And like Twitter, I don't post much on Twitter, and I don't have very many followers at all, but I read it all the time. It's almost my main source of news.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have little kids. So like the past few weeks I've had to physically separate myself from my phone because I'm like, oh my God, I am not going to be the person who dropped their baby because they were rushing to see a direct message from someone, some stranger who just read the book. So, but that's how, I mean, I get it. I get it now because it's very, very irresistible.
Well, what are you going to do about devices with your kids? I mean, that's like a big issue for parents today. I have grandkids that are 7 and 10, and they're pretty well balanced. You know, they do a lot of physical activity and a lot of really creative play. But they both love their devices. And in fact, my granddaughter learned to crawl to get to the laptop. By the time she was two, she knew how to use an Amazon, a Kindle, an iPhone, a Google phone, and something else by the time she was two. She was searching for YouTube. You know, she would seek out YouTube videos by the time she was three. It's like... Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, I I have a similar tack. My kids are 5, 3, and 1. So I'm still at the beginning, but you know, I will let them have a little television now and again. I'll let them play an iPad game. It's more important to me that they don't feel a sense of ownership over it, that they feel like they get it whenever they want. And so I've kept it kind of a special treat. But like, I have to say, I spent a lot of time in the beginning thinking about what is going to be my strategy? When will I give them the phone? When will I do this? And lately, I've really turned that lens on myself. I really feel like the most important thing for me right now is not letting them see me on it so much, and not letting that be like sort of their go-to mental image of me. So once again, I really do try to leave it in the other room. If I'm on it and I hear them coming towards me, I make every effort to put it down, so that I just don't want them to have that mental image of me distracted all the time.
And but then of course there's like the Apple Watch, and you know where.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's on and on. And by the way, I never ever let them have my phone, and that is less out of principle than it is selfishness. I'm just like, I have nothing left in this house. You've taken over everything. You are not touching my phone.
Well, you know, that's interesting because I let my granddaughter play on my phone all the time when I'm there, and her parents don't really like that. And they don't mind that I let her. They don't want to let her play on theirs. And I bet that's part of the reason.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I mean, we have nothing left. We're just ravaged. Just let us have our little phone.
So when did you start writing Followers?
I started writing Followers. I started thinking about it pretty seriously towards the end of 2015. And then I had the whole thing outlined. I finished my outline in October of 2016. And I started to write the draft in earnest in November 2016.
So you outlined it before you started writing?
Yes. Actually, so the creative writing I had done before this book was all scripts. I was trying to break into television or feature writing for years before this. And I would, you know, I'd like write a TV pilot. Somebody would take some interest. It would kind of get through, you know, some levels of development, but never really cross the finish line. I never had anything made. And when I thought of this idea, I wanted to write it as a movie first. But I had been through enough development to understand that the idea I had would be like, you know, a $300 million movie, and I'm not Michael Bay, and no one's going to give me $300 million. So I was like, okay, I think I'm going to try to write it as a book, and we'll see where it goes from there. So outlines are something I have to have. I'm not an artist in the way that I can sit down and just do a draft all the way through.
So definitely when you started writing, you knew where you were going and where you would end up.
Yeah, I did. I mean, there were definitely drafts of this book that, like, believe it or not, were like 100 or 150 pages longer. So some of the stuff fell out, but that was mostly because I think I felt sort of this amateurish pressure in the beginning to tell everybody what every aspect of the future looks like, what was going on with climate and food famine and all these different things. And like eventually I realized you can't do that. It's going to be really boring. It's going to read like a book report, and you just have to stick to the parts of the future that belong in this story.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Megan Angelo, author of Followers. Megan, why don't you read a section from the book for us?
I would love to. The section I'm going to read is from the 2015 timeline. And so this is where Orla, who is the blogger, and Floss, who is the influencer wannabe, have sort of embarked on this scheme to make Floss famous and thus launch Orla into, you know, like a more illustrious writing career too. So this passage is really about how the sausage gets made. Right from the start, it was suspiciously easy. At least Orla should have been suspicious of how easy it was. Two girls hijacking the public eye from the floor of their Chelsea rental. Her mistake was seeing the ease, the way things ribboned out in front of her in floss, as a sign she was on the right path. They started the way everyone did. They shared. Floss posted pictures online of herself, her things, her food, constantly, as if she was someone whose meals became fascinating just by virtue of her being in front of them. Nobody ever said, as Orla worried they would, with respect, what do you do for a living? Floss didn't even have a proper bio on any of her platforms, just a quote. There is no security on this earth. There is only opportunity. She had attributed it to Britney Spears before Orla plugged it into Google and found that it had been said by General Douglas MacArthur. One day, Floss prepared to post a Snapchat of herself explaining how to apply brow gel. So fire, she rehearsed as she ran the brush across her arches. So fire. A thought came to Orla, torn from the script of people more famous than Floss. You know what I think you should do at the end, Orla said? Say that you don't have a deal with them, the brow gel people. Say, like, I swear they're not even paying me to say this. Why? Floss jammed the wand back into its bottle and stretched her eyes in the mirror. Because then people will think that other brands do pay you, Orla said, to talk about their stuff. That was at 7:30 in the morning. As Floss mulled the idea, Orla showered, then went to work. She was at her desk when Floss posted the video at 8:45 a.m. I'm not getting any money for this either, you guys, Floss sang dutifully. At 9:03 a.m., Orla sent the video to Ingrid, who popped her head out of her office 30 seconds later. Her lips were coral. Ladyish had recently taken a firm stance on coral being the new red. Orla, Ingrid called, why do I care this girl's doing her eyebrows? It's Floss Natuzzi, Orla said. She's big on Insta. Plus, you know that $100 brow gel from that Korean beauty line that doesn't write anything on their packaging? It looks from the video like she might be one of the first stars here they sent it to. It did look like that because just before stepping onto the elevator at home, Orla had run back to the apartment, scraped the lettering from an old Maybelline tube, and pressed it into Floss's hand. Fine, Ingrid said, and slid her door shut. At 9:27 a.m., Orla published the post. So, what does the world's most expensive brow gel actually do? One Instagram it girl finds out. Then she cupped her phone in her hands and swiped to Floss's Twitter account. As Floss, Orla tweeted the link to the post, tagging Ladyish. She waited. 2 minutes later, Orla got an email from Ingrid. Floss tweeted our post. What a sweetheart. RT from Ladyish, please. That was the thing about Ingrid. Every semi-famous person disgusted her right up until the second they threw her a bone. Orla used her computer to log into the Ladyish account and retweeted the missive she had written as Floss. She quickly silenced her phone, muffling the incoming notifications of Floss's new followers. It was 9:30 on the nose. That night, when Orla got home, Floss was waiting for her at the door. So was a crate of cream-flavored vodka, a pallet of whispery diet chips, and a dozen $40 lipsticks arranged like chocolates inside a black box. This one came by messenger, Floss said, and he asked me for a selfie. The more she tweeted, the less they spent. Orla found herself living almost entirely off Floss's loot. Their apartment filled up with the sort of things Orla never would have chosen for herself. Gluten-free freezer meals with a pop star's face on the box, shoes downy with calf hair, purses pimpled with ostrich flesh, but she ate them and wore them eagerly because they were free and they were proof. She and Floss were succeeding. The doorman never grinned at them anymore. Package, he said wearily over and over, rising from his stool when he saw one of them coming. Orla sometimes slipped him bags of free cookies or chips, removing the hopeful notes from entry-level PR girls. Almost invariably, the girls were named Alyssa. Orla didn't have time most nights to work on writing her book. As soon as she walked in the door, Floss would hand her a bowl of Apple Jacks for dinner. They would sit cross-legged on the parquet, a laptop between them, and work. Before long, Floss would be begged to attend all sorts of events, dozens a week. But in the meantime, she had found a way to hack into several publicists' email accounts, to keep track of what invites were going around. She forwarded the invites to an address she made up for her imaginary publicist, Pat White. Gender neutral and forgettable, she said of the name. As Pat, Orla RSVP'd Floss to events she hadn't been asked to, saying she would be there, plus one. Floss made Orla swear she'd never tell anyone about the scheme. I could get in trouble, she said, but Orla knew that wasn't it. Hacking required intelligence, and intelligence was off-brand. Orla was in charge of writing about Floss on Labiash, and of breaking down the shipping cardboard the free things came in, and of maintaining Floss's Twitter account. She changed the password on it twice weekly, dutifully jumbling numbers and letters with asterisks and exclamation points. Of course, even as she concocted them, the passwords were already useless. It would almost make her laugh later, after the spill, remembering how she labored over those combinations. They all thought special characters would save them. One day, Orla got Floss to trend worldwide by lashing out at a snack company's corporate account. The operative behind it had called a recipe for bruschetta made with its wheat crisps, quote, an Italian wonder on par with the Sistine Chapel. As Floss, Orla bombarded them with claims that the comparison offended her on behalf of Italians and Italian Americans, a, quote, group that continues to be underestimated in culture. Even though Floss was only one-eighth Sicilian, half Latina, and a few other things she claimed not to recall. The whole time her online ego was battling crackers, Floss herself was at the gym, doing arm day with a famous trainer who was very expensive if one wasn't sleeping with him. Orla didn't even run the stunt by her. Floss's identity had become a thing they shared respectfully, like the skim milk in the fridge. As Orla sat at her desk at Ladyish, stabbing out a call to boycott the snack company from Floss's handle, Ingrid instant messaged her. Did you see Floss going crazy about racist crackers? Thread, she wrote, linking Orla to Orla's own handiwork. Go ahead and post. Dude, you practically invented her. Orla thought, you have no idea. She was electric with adrenaline. All these years in the city, she had been telling herself in the bathroom mirror that she was a modern woman chasing modern goals. But sometimes as her subway car went through the tunnel, she'd catch a glimpse of herself in its smudged glass window and see herself the way the world did. Another girl with a dream and a hemline set precisely knee high, low enough that no catcaller should notice it, that no coworker should factor it into her credibility. There, on the darkest part of the ride, as the train nearly kissed the one running parallel, Orla often caught her breath at how dispensable she looked. But now, with nothing but her job and her phone and her instincts, she had claimed a minor superpower. She had made someone famous just by saying it was so.
And that's Megan Angelo reading from Followers. So, as a former journalist, or current journalist too, I'm sure, and a blogger, how much is Orla like you?
Well, Orla, you know, it goes back to sort of, yeah, who I was in my 20s. And I mean, look, I think that Orla is like me. But after like three drinks and a really bad week at work, like she's definitely more bitter than I was. But the thing that I share with her is, you know, I came to New York in 2006 and I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write creatively somehow. And I wanted to be a serious journalist too. It was my dream, like growing up, to work for Vanity Fair. But the industry was in a huge amount of flux when I got there, and I was sitting on my computer at night, you know, trying to make every story perfect and trying to write creatively and sort of going about things the traditional way, while at the same time, it was the golden age of like, if you had a really funny YouTube video, all of a sudden you had a big pilot deal at NBC, or if you had a very clever Tumblr, then you were getting a deal to write a memoir for Random House. So it was driving me crazy because I was like, I'm trying to do things the right way. Is any of this ever going to pay off? And that definitely put me in a place that I think Orla is in sometimes too, where it can become very tempting to try to look for a shortcut.
Wow. I always think about Julie and Julia. Do you remember, remember that? Where she?
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And she was just blogging about trying to, the author Julie was blogging about trying to cook her way through Julia Child's French cookbook and got a whole book deal and eventually a movie out of it. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, yeah. It is. And so I felt like that stuff was swirling all around me at the time. And I was just such a lifelong rule follower, do it by the book, write the cover letter, get the internship, get the coffee. And I was thinking, like, am I just a chump? Are other people, you know, going to beat me to all of these dreams because they've found these new flashy ways to do it?
And what have you decided about that?
Well, look, it's really easy to have a lot of perspective 10 years later. I'm glad I did it this way. I don't think I ever really had a choice, though. As tempted as I was, you know, to try to find some sort of shortcut, I was never going to be a person who, you know, would try to be an influencer or wanted to be on camera in any way, wanted to really play the game in ways you have to get noticed on those levels sometimes. I don't even take selfies of myself. I'm a little too old for sort of the very strategic ways that I think some people are good at packaging themselves on the internet.
So for you, the old-fashioned way seems to have brought success. Do you think it still would for someone starting out now?
That's a great question. It's so strange. I mean, I almost feel unqualified to answer, and I think that's because I feel like a dinosaur already. I mean, I'm 35 and I've been working in media for, I don't know, between 10 and 15 years.
Oh my.
But it's just, I know, but here's the thing. It's changed so much that I have kids who, every once in a while, I'll get a kid who will write to my website. Sometimes it's like they went to the same college as me or something like that. And they want to work in journalism, and I don't even know what to tell them because the ground kind of fell out from under me in journalism. It has all changed so quickly that all the things that used to work for me, no, I don't think they would work for kids now. And they wouldn't, they're not even trying to get the same things that I did because a lot of those places don't exist anymore.
So are you still writing articles as well?
I would like to be. This is like the longest I've ever gone without having a regular gig in journalism. But I think it's a confluence of not just the book keeping me busy and the kids keeping me busy, but I'm sort of out of hot takes. Like for a decade, I was writing some traditional pieces. You know, I would do like profiles for Glamour, and I wrote a lot about comedy and television for the New York Times, where obviously that's not, you know, my own voice or my own opinion. But my day-to-day work was essentially coming up with columns to write for websites. It was less reported work. And I think after literally thousands of them, I'm just out of opinions. Like days go by and I don't have an opinion that I can package and sell to someone. So maybe that will come back, or maybe I'll find a different way into it. I don't know, but it's something that I've always loved doing.
I'm looking at your website, which is meganangelo.com, and the portfolio of other writing, and looking at some of the titles, like it from Elle, How the Women of the Handmaid's Tale Do Self-Care in Dystopia. want to give me a hint with that one?
You know what? That was I actually remember that one. And I'll tell you what, like you could pick any headline and I'd be like, I don't remember, Monica. I don't know. It was a lot of them. But that one, I actually asked them, like, how do you deal with, you know, these crazy themes in this world that you have to live in while you're shooting? How do you take it all off at the end of the day? And I don't know why I loved this so much, but Ann Dowd, who is so talented and lovely and who plays Aunt Lydia on the show, told me that she loved to just like pick up smooth rocks and hold them in her hands, and that she would take rocks from everywhere she shot. And it was just the most beautiful antidote to thinking about, you know, $150 face serums or however anyone else was going to do it. So I loved Ann Dowd for that.
I pick up rocks everywhere I go too.
Do you really? That's such a lovely idea.
I always bring them home. Or now I give them to my grandkids, or I gave the last, I was on the beach in Deerfield Beach a few weeks ago, and I brought back a few rocks and gave them to my niece, my great niece, and she loved them. So
that is so sweet. I love that.
I know. Well, rocks are beautiful.
They are.
And
love a good rock.
Yeah, really. So mostly, it does seem like you mostly were talking about celebrities or pop culture, most of these articles. Not all, though.
Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, I sort of, my work kind of existed on a spectrum where, you know, if I was writing for the Times, it was this very straightforward arts and leisure coverage. And at Glamour, I wore a number of different hats. I had a column about women in television for a while. And I wrote a couple cover stories. I did a lot of Guy of the Month profiles, and I wrote a ton for the website, just sort of covering everyday pop culture and writing about what it meant for women, and also recapping The Bachelor, which I think was one of the most successful things I ever did. People loved, like, and I loved doing it too. It was really fun and funny. I should say that Glamour is not like Lady-ish in the book. Lady-ish is sort of this more of like a tabloid factory, cheap news kind of thing. And Glamour was a place that I absolutely loved working. I worked under Cindy Levy and Lauren Brody and Wendy Noggle there. And just an incredible magazine and website. Not every magazine was able to sort of rise to the challenge of how to get into the digital era. And I thought Glamour did it beautifully. And I really cherish all my memories of working with the very talented people there.
What do you see as the future of journalism?
That's a big one.
Yeah, really.
That's a big one on a Friday afternoon. You know, I don't know, but what I will say is that what concerns me more than anything is the disappearance of local journalism, because I don't know if people connect the dots all the time, but I think that it's one of the things that has contributed most to sort of the polarized moment we're in. I mean, there's plenty of chatter you're always going to be able to find on cable news and in sort of national media. But the thing that united us on a local level is kind of gone. Like, even if you didn't vote the same way as your neighbor, maybe you were sort of both concerned about what's going on at the high school or what's going on, you know, from the last town council meeting. And there's so many institutions that don't get held accountable when a local newspaper goes away. So my big hope for the future of journalism is that somebody realizes that and finds a way to make some kind of business model work that will kind of bring that back and cement its place in the next century.
What about you? Could you do that?
Who, me?
Yeah,
well,
you.
I don't know. Maybe if I sell a few more things, Monica, I don't know. I think it's going to take some funds. Like, I think it needs to be, you know, someone like a Bezos or somebody like that who overnight is like, maybe this will be my legacy. Because that would be a way better legacy than Amazon, right? Like, okay, there's my, why am I talking about Amazon when I'm trying to sell a book? Let's move on to another question. Sorry, Jeff Bezos. You're doing a great job.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, And I'm Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Megan Angelo, author of Followers. Do you have, of the three women who are your main characters in this book, which are Orla, Floss, and Marlo, do you have someone that you miss the most now that you're finished with it?
I don't miss any of them as much as I miss Aston, who is Floss's boyfriend. He's sort of this mashup of Justin Bieber and Shia LaBeouf, and he's just like, he's this massive star, but he thinks everything he does is performance art, and he's incredibly insufferable on the surface, but he sort of has this childlike heart of gold deep down. And he really, he was like my buddy on days where all three of those women made me just want to get up and never come back, because they can be really horrible at times. I miss Aston the most.
Now, there's also quite a few humanoid robots featuring in the future years. Are you a lover of kind of the, like the droids on Star Wars and that type of character?
I'm really not. And it's funny you said that, because I am married to someone who loves Star Wars and grew up in a Star Wars house. And I sometimes will horrify him or my brother-in-law by saying, like, now wait, is that the brass one? And they're just like, Megan, stop. It's funny. I mean, I definitely was not in any sort of comfort zone inventing technology. And in fact, like I said, you know, I really was trying to write the future from a more human standpoint, but of course technology had to enter in. So I gave a lot of thought to not just what I wanted the bots to be like and how I wanted them to function, but sort of how would we real humans treat them? And, you know, I've seen a lot of sci-fi where a bot walks over and a human person just speaks to it very politely. I'm not so sure that's how it would go. Like, we're kind of lazy intrinsically, and we probably wouldn't be as nice. So I spent a lot of time thinking again about sort of the social aspect of all of that stuff.
And some of the bots are very humanistic or human-like. They look like you have to look close to tell whether they're real or not. Whereas others are not, because obviously it's much more expensive to make one that's very human-like than it is to make one that's not. And so depending on their function, and then there's droids. And it seemed like it would be really hard to have any real privacy in a world that's populated by bots.
Yeah, I mean, the time that the book is set in 2051, it's interesting because, yeah, that technology can freak you out a little bit, but I actually think, at least in 2051, they're struggling with the concept of privacy. They're thinking, you know, some people have kind of gone off the grid and stayed off the grid after the spill, and other people are coming back to it. And then at the extreme of sharing, you have the celebrities and Constellation who are on all the time, but it's a fragmented thing and it's a subject of debate. Whereas now, maybe our world, like, looks a lot more normal to us on the surface, but I read reports every day about the tens of thousands of data points and, you know, location information points that are being gathered on all of us every single day. And I'm just still kind of walking around like everything's fine.
I know. And there's ways that you can turn off some of this, but I don't think about it enough to do it. I just popped up today an email saying, here's your Google timeline for last month, which I think is going to tell me everywhere I went. And, you know, it's like, well, I don't have any secrets, so does it really matter? But maybe I should shut this stuff off. My mom got totally freaked out because she's had a cell phone for some time. She's 84. But we recently got her first really smartphone. We got her an Apple so that she could have an Apple Watch because it has fall detection on it.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, and it's better than the service that we had before because it was she had to wear this big clunky thing, and she never wanted to wear it, and because it was too big and too clunky, and it called, if she dropped it, they would call her, and she'd be embarrassed about that. And so the mm-hmm. Apple Watch seemed to be better. But the other day, she's on her landline, she's not even near her phone, and she's talking to her friend about somebody looking for a job, and then she suddenly gets a text or a message on her phone saying, we can get information on job postings for you. And she thought that was just, she really did not like that, because she wasn't even talking on her phone.
Right. It's that eavesdropping aspect that I think a lot of us, that's sort of been the red line for a lot of us. Like, I've had moments like that too. And it really, really freaks me out. And at first I was like, what can I do about this? I need to push back against this. And then I'm a little ashamed to tell you that probably within a few months, I was like, I can't find a good pair of black boots. And I just started being like, black boots, saying it out loud, Googling it on my browser, and, you know, was pleased when 2 hours later, here are all the black boots in my Instagram feed. So, you know, no muss, no fuss. It's weird. It's very weird.
I know.
Right?
We can get used to it pretty quickly, pretty quickly. So, Megan, let's talk a little bit about your path to publication. So you are being published, and the book just came out, and your publisher is Graydon House Books. And it's tell us how you found your publisher, and at what point in the writing process did you start looking for a publisher, and how did you go about it?
Well, I was very lucky to have, I'm represented by a fantastic agent named Stephanie Lieberman, as well as her associate Molly Steinblatt at Janklow & Nesbitt. And they really worked with me on this book. I mean, I think I'm probably not unusual in that the second I was done a draft of this book, I was like, the book is done and it's ready to go. Here you go. And they were like, no, we're going to, you know, they really pushed me on it. We did a ton of revisions ourselves. And then when they check it out, really all the credit goes to them for finding a wonderful home for it at Graydon House, which is a subsidiary of Harlequin and HarperCollins. So I had a wonderful editor there named Brittany Lavery, who really saw the vision of the book, helped me with the pacing of it a little bit. And I mean, none of this sounds that interesting as I'm saying it, but when you've read the book, you sort of see that there's a lot going on, and it took a lot of people to help me package it in a way that it was going to be really compelling and clear to the reader. So I'm really grateful I had such a great team on it.
Oh. And Graydon House, I'm just looking at their website. They say they focus on publishing book club worthy women's fiction with strong commercial appeal. And I do, one of their other authors is someone we've had on Writer's Voices before, Kyra Ruda, with her previous book.
Yeah.
She's got a new one out.
And they also, I don't know if you've heard of the book The Wives by Taryn Fisher, but that is a fantastic thriller. I think it's on the bestseller list right now. And Taryn is a force of nature. It's a really great read.
Oh, cool. Oh, cool. So you're in good company here. Have you?
Yes.
Been read by book clubs yet? Have you gotten any feedback from that?
I have. Like, I've gotten a lot of people telling me that they're picking it for the book club, bookshops, and now there's, I guess this is the month when a lot of people are reading it, and I'm also very lucky to be the February book club pick for Marie Claire Magazine's book club and for Bad on Paper, which is a very popular podcast among book lovers, and their book club pick as well. And if I'm and Bitch Media, and their book club pick as well.
Well, congratulations. One of your blurb writers, Christina Dulcher, author of Vox, is also a former Writer's Voices guest. And that book was really
wonderful.
Something. Man, that
isn't
was
it?
Yeah.
She's brilliant. I think she has another one coming out in the spring. I cannot wait to read it.
Wow. Do you read a lot of kind of women's suspense thriller type books yourself?
Yeah, I love a good literary thriller. I love Megan Abbott. I obviously love Gillian Flynn. I'm pretty much, oh, I love Jessica Knoll too. I am really like a classically contemporary lit fiction reader. You know, most of my favorite authors, Anna Quinlan, Curtis Sittenfeld, Jennifer Close, Jhumpa Lahiri, like I'm really a lit fiction girl, but I love to read books that are sort of genre, but with lit fiction mixed in.
Well, I think that you described yourself pretty well there.
Oh, thank you. Good.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I found Followers to be quite a page turner. It was something I really got into and couldn't wait to finish reading. And some, you know, when I'm reading a book every week for the show, sometimes I love all of our guests and I love all their books, but sometimes it can be a little bit of a plod to get through a book and to get through that many books, you know, but yours was no problem at all. Believe me.
Well, thank you. I love hearing that.
Well, you're welcome. And we only have a minute or so, but so just tell us what's next.
What is next? Maybe someone could quickly call in and tell me what's next. No, I'm working on a book, another book that sort of has elements of technology and female friendship as well. It's set before Y2K. So it's sort of like when the internet was still just something in your living room, that kind of thing. Mm. And I'm working on some
historical fiction.
As well. Historical fiction, yes. I like to make myself feel very old and like a relic, and so.
Wow, it's amazing how much life has changed in our lives. You know how much the world has
yes,
changed.
It has. And, yeah, I know.
Yeah, so. And what was the last thing that you said then after that, after the book about before Y2K? There was one more thing you mentioned.
Oh, yes. And I'm working on some scripts as well, a couple of series projects that I hope will go out and find a little home. And we'll see if I get any further in development. But if not, you know, been there before.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. We usually close with a quote that my mother finds, but since she's not here, I looked up some quotes on being famous because, in a way, that's what Followers is about. And this is from Ellen DeGeneres. When we were growing up, our parents somehow made it clear that being famous was good, and I mistakenly thought that if I was famous, then everyone would love me.
Ooh, that is so good.
Yeah. Well, thank
you. I'm gonna be thinking about that all day.
Thank you for being with us today, Megan.
Thank you, Monica. Thanks so much.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.